Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are here joined by Eddie Brown. Eddie Brown is the founder and CEO of Brown Capital Management, president of Brown Capital Management. I've known Eddie for a long time, and we put this disclaimer out. I shall put this disclaimer out that his son-in-law is a member of the board of directors of the Center for Emerging Media that produces, that is where this show is produced from. So all that on the table, so there's no, you know, no hidden agendas here. Eddie, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
Eddie Brown has written a book, Beating the Odds, Eddie Brown's Investing in Life Strategies, and it's about his life story, some of which I knew, but much of this is new. And reminding you, tomorrow night after you hear this, at least to me it's new, and it will be to you as well. Tomorrow night you can meet Ed Brown at the Enoch Pratt Library, tomorrow at 7 o'clock, May 10th, he'll be talking about his book and his life, Beating the Odds. And we'll tell you more about that and continue talking about that, so you go there tomorrow night and fill up the seats to hear this conversation. So, Eddie, welcome. Good, really good to have you in the studio.
So, same here, Mark. It's super.
So it's you know, we always hear about Eddie Brown because you have the Brown Center at MICA that was built, and you built it for the Maryland Institute College of Art, and your name is a philanthropist in the city and all the things you've done. Mm-hmm. But at the beginning, few people would imagine where your life started.
In this very small town, at that time it was only about 2,000 people, in Central Florida. We always like to say that Orlando, Florida, is a suburb of Apopka. Apopka is about 13 miles from Orlando, and that's where I was born and lived until I was around 13 years old.
Well, 13 years old. You were born to a 13-year-old.
Yeah, something magic about that number. My mother never really knew my father. I think I met him once. But my mother had me when she was 13 years old. And when she was 15, I think she realized that she couldn't really care for me. So she left home and went north when she was 15. And I was reared then by my grandparents.
These three people who became the kind of cornerstone of your life.
That's correct.
Your younger years. I have a lot to think about as I was thinking about the big three as you put them in your book.
Mm-hmm.
In your younger days, your grandfather Jake Brown and your grandmother,
Mamie,
and your uncle Jake.
That's correct. That was the core.
The core.
Growing up.
So these older people raised you.
Yes. However, I spent a lot of time with my uncle.
Your Uncle Jake.
My Uncle Jake.
Very interesting character, this Uncle Jake.
As they say, he was the man.
You really loved him, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I really.
He was very special in your eyes.
I idolized him because, you know, he had it all. He had, I guess you would call it, swagger. He was loved by the ladies. And really feared by the men. You know, he packed a pistol.
This is the 1940s we're talking about, right?
Yes, this would be...
late 40s, early 50s.
Early 50s, that's
right,
correct.
Right.
You know, I was born in 1940. And he was, as you said, really a character. He, I guess what I admired most... is that he had always been his, since I'd known him, had always been his own boss. He had never worked for anyone. When I was very young.
Which is pretty odd for a black man in that period in the South.
That's right. He was the classic entrepreneur,
right.
You know. And if he had a good education, he probably could have been the CEO of a Fortune 500 company.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was that kind of person. So what he did was he... when he was doing legitimate business, he actually had a number of large trucks. He would go to Alabama, Georgia, and he would hire migrant workers. He had contracts with some of the major citrus growers. At that time, Central Florida was kind of the place for oranges, grapefruit, basically the citrus belt. That's no longer the case. It's moved further south.
Yes.
But he would bring these migrant workers during the harvest season. And I'll never forget, when I was around 6 years old, He took me out to the orange groves and put me behind the wheel.
Taught you how to drive at 6 years old.
Yes, in one of these big trucks. And he said, all
how
I have to do.
How did your feet reach the pedal?
Well, that's, well, it, they didn't.
They raced.
No, what they had on those trucks at that time is a throttle on the dashboard. So he would start the truck down the aisle, and all I had to do was really just keep it going straight until I got to the end. I could regulate it, the speed, with the throttle on the dashboard. When I got to the end of a row, all I had to do was make a big turn and head back in the other direction. And in the meantime, all of these pickers were actually just dumping boxes of fruit in the back of this huge, huge truck. Yeah, so that was very early, 6 years old.
But now, as you read, especially in this chapter, the Prince of Apopka, who was your uncle,
yes.
Uncle Jake, you drove more than just this truck for your uncle.
Yes, as I got a little bit older, he actually gave me a 1936 Ford pickup truck for me to have. But I think, Mark, what you're referring to is he kind of moved into a more, I guess, illegitimate business, was the moonshine business. And he became really the largest moonshine distributor in the state of Florida. And to, I guess, stay out of jail, he had 12 souped-up cars that he would stash away in various places, and he would just have one car at a time, and he kept changing vehicles. And so he would let me drive these cars.
You were 6, 8, 10 years old when you
were
doing this.
Yeah, I was 10 and 11 when I started driving the cars, and as I said, he gave me my own pickup truck when I was 11.
And he put this, you see, is this real? Were you a $1,000 bill?
Yes. each Sunday.
I mean, a black man with a $1,000 bill in Florida in 1951 was
dangerous. No, it was really funny, but he made it clear now, this is not to be spent. This is just for you to have to show. You know, and so I would, he would give me one of the cars, and my job would be to wash and wax that car that particular Sunday. And then I can have it for the rest of the day, along with my $1,000 bill, just to drive around Apopka. Now, you might wonder, now, how an 11-year-older driving around Apopka, how can that be? And I was never stopped by the policeman. And the reason I found out much later is that he had all of the local policemen in his pocket, you know, paid off. And basically, he could do anything he wanted. I could do anything I wanted in terms of just driving around at these very young ages.
So, but then one day, the police showed up, who he must not have paid off.
Yeah, well, what happened many years later, this went on and on for many, many years, is I remember this as if it was yesterday. One night, I was at my grandmother's, and my uncle pulled into the rear, into the backyard, and all of a sudden, these men started coming from all directions from the orange grove. We had an orange grove in the back of our home with guns drawn. And my uncle hopped into this car and just took off. And they scrambled, got into their car or cars, and took off behind him. And I found out the next day that they never really caught him, because his car would go 140 miles per hour, each one of those cars. He had souped them up. He could outrun any of the policemen. And he got away. But I found out the next day that they had actually shot the back windows out. I mean, this was a serious chase. But he did get away. And what happened, he found out later, is that after many years of trying to figure this out, the federal authorities did not notify the local authorities that they were coming in to do this raid. So that's the way they finally caught him, with an informant.
So one of the things that struck me as I was reading this chapter, and you actually mentioned something about this later on in the book, but two things. One, this overarching story of your Uncle Jake, your grandmother, and your grandfather,
mm-hmm.
very independent figures.
Correct.
Very strong figures.
Very.
Who didn't kind of bend down to the oppression of segregation, but lived their lives, were aware. They lived their lives.
Correct.
And even your mother, who we'll talk about a bit later, who moved on,
mm-hmm.
Who you reconnected with later, there was a strength in her as well. This girl who was once 13 became a woman, and you saw her later in life.
That's correct.
But so I was thinking about that in terms of who you became, who you have become now, mm-hmm. in terms of the root you came from with these people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, you know, what really stood out as I was growing up with my grandfather and grandmother is they were really hardworking. They got up very early, came home very late, working every single weekday. They would go out, of course, in work clothes. They would have overalls for my grandfather and my grandmother, you know, work clothes. And she would say to me, "Now, if you stay in school and do well and go to college, you can live a better life." And she would take me over to the big city, Orlando, and she would show me men sitting behind a desk with white shirts and a tie.
White men.
White men, of course. And she said, you know, see, that's what you can become. You can dress like that. You can sit behind a desk with a white shirt and tie. If you go to school and do well and go to college, you don't have to work in the fields. So at a very young age, that made a big impression on me. Fortunately, I was fairly smart. You know, the thing about the South, the segregated South, the schools, the teachers were just so dedicated, and they provided so much encouragement, and they just constantly built my self-confidence, you know, by saying, "You are really smart. You know, you can really make something
black
of yourself."
Teachers.
Black teachers.
All black segregated schools.
All black segregated schools. And so there was this whole support system that really provided just a very strong foundation and just gave me a lot of self-confidence, you know, right from the beginning.
And you also were a kid, you see, described yourself as a straight-A student.
That's correct.
And also driving the hooch cars to get the your uncle's illegal liquor
right.
moving at the same time.
Right. I was having a ball. Absolute ball.
So I wonder, and you mentioned this a little bit later in the book, but how that, as you've grown older and become this wealthy man, built a big business, philanthropist, and you see what happens to so many young people and people in the inner cities and in poor communities who are selling marijuana, who are sell heroin, who sell whatever they're selling.
Mm-hmm.
And reflecting on that world you see here now, and the world of your Uncle Jake, because they're not dissimilar, really.
That is true. You know, but I would say, I think the key for younger people is to get a very good education. I think that's the key out of the ghetto to a better life. You know, not drug dealing, not the illegal right. business, but to get a solid foundation and basically participate in the capitalistic system that is America.
I mean, it made me think of my grandfather who made gin in his bathtub in the east side of Baltimore to sell to his neighbors as a way of boosting his income.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what, you know, so that it often makes me feel a little bit more empathetic with folks that we want to always label as criminals who actually could be doing something else if there was another way to do something.
That's correct.
But you write about this very sad scene in your book that really affected you deeply. The three people in your life, your grandmother, your grandfather, and your uncle,
mm-hmm.
that raised you, these very strong, powerful, older black people. You're driving north.
Correct.
And you...
Yeah, I think we got to South Carolina, and we were... My uncle was driving the car, and was my grandmother and myself in the car. And we were on the way to Allentown, Pennsylvania, where my mother had settled. And that was my grandmother's first time really driving north. And she had a heart attack. And we didn't know what was going on. We just know that she was perspiring and she was just very uncomfortable. And, of course, things were segregated. So we stopped at a home that we identified as being a black home to ask where is the nearest hospital, black hospital. And they actually took us there. And they treated her, but they couldn't save her. So she passed away. Completely unexpected, and that was 1955. And that was a bad day for me.
More than a bad day. I mean, it had a profound effect on you. That was...
Yeah, that was my anchor. And so that just kind of, you know, took the wind out of my sails for a long, long time. So we had her body shipped back to Apopka, and... My uncle and I, you know, took that long drive back, and I was just kind of at a loss, you know, of, you know, what do I do now? She's gone. And that's when my second cousin made a call that really, I think, made the difference between where I am now and probably where I would have been. You know, I call... You know, if you look back through your life, you can identify several what I call critical forks in the road. If I'd taken this fork, you know, this probably would have happened. And if I'd taken this fork, this would have happened. That was a critical fork, that phone call that my second cousin made to my mother. And she said, come and get this boy. She said, he is going in the wrong direction. Because after my grandmother passed, I was just kind of free, you know. My grandfather, you know, watched after me, but I could leave home. You know, I could stay out all night if I wanted to. And, you know, he wasn't watching me that closely. I could slip out of the house and go run around with my uncle. And so my mother just appeared one day and said, you're coming with me.
You didn't want to.
Didn't want to. In fact, by that time, I think I was in 10th grade. My I'd gone to this high school. And by the way, in Apopka High School was white only. So in Apopka, we could only go through 8th grade. It's a school called Phyllis Wheatley, still there, but could only go through 8th grade. We had to be bused over to a little town, Eatonville, to go to high school. And
Zora Neale Hurston, is that where she got the name Eatonville
from? That's where Zora Neale Hurston's museum is, and that's where she spent a good portion of her adult life, was in Eatonville.
Right.
Eatonville has two historical significances. One, it was the first all-black town in the United States, and the second thing for its fame is Zora Neale Hurston.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, I went there. Again, the teachers were just great. In fact, it was an English teacher that told me, you are just very smart. You have to go to college, and you have to go to Howard University. And I said, why Howard? She said, well, that's where I went. And it's a great school. And that's where you
should... The Black Harvard in those days.
Yeah, that was a Black Harvard. And that's where you should go. And you're smart enough, you know, to get there. And so all the teachers, you know, had a very good relationship with the principal. And the reason I mention that is because when my mother swooped in to take me back to Pennsylvania to get from under the influence of my uncle and all of the things I was doing, that the principal of that high school said, my wife and I would like to take him in and take care of him. You know, we really want him to stay here mm-hmm. and finish high school. And my mother thanked them, but said, no, I'm taking him back to Pennsylvania.
It was just shocking. I know it must have been, as I can feel it from your book, it was very shocking to have your mother, who gave birth to you when she was 13, who left and went north, raised by then your grandparents and your uncle, just all of a sudden show up and
yes,
say,
now,
I want my son back.
Yeah, to be fair, I had visited.
You spent summers in Allentown, right?
Yeah, I spent summers in Allentown for many years. So I did, you know her as an adult, and I kind of liked Allentown, but I didn't really want to just move there to live. But I wasn't given a choice.
I mean, and it was a very different world in Allentown. You describe how your relationship with your mother was different and remained different.
Yeah.
Despite her support of you.
That's correct. It was almost like a sister-brother relationship as opposed to a mother-child relationship.
Right.
And so she...
She was, 27, 28 when she took you to Allentown? You were
15. She was 26, and I was 13, I think, at the time. So, yeah. It was a different relationship.
So you moved to Allentown, and you were in this little, mostly white town that had a black population.
Small black population.
And you lived on the black side of town.
That's correct. There was a black section.
There's always a black section.
Right. That was, it was a poor section.
Right.
You know, the thing that I reflect on is it wasn't until I went to Howard University. By the way, when I applied for college.
That's a great story.
I didn't know anything about colleges, but I remembered what my English teacher in 10th grade had said, you have to go to Howard University. So I only applied to one school. That's the only school I knew, Howard University. Fortunately, I was accepted.
And you had this benefactor.
Yes. The interesting thing about Allentown is, as you said, it was a very small black population. In my graduating class from Allentown High School, I think we had a graduating class of 753 students, but only 3 African Americans in college prep. And they tried to put me in industrial arts, by the way,
and your
vocational.
That's where you saw your mother's fire.
She came storming to the school, and this was when I first, got there from the South. The tradition then was, if you're black from the South, you're put back a grade, and you're steered towards vocational ed. And that's exactly what they tried to do, even though I was a straight-A student, top of my class all the way through. They tried to put me back and put me in vocational ed. My mother, who only had a 9th grade education, said, well, how is he going to go to college? She knew enough to know that vocational ed was not going to prepare me to go to college. And she fought the system. And finally, they relinquished. But when this gentleman in the black section of town in Allentown, his name is, he's deceased now, but Mr. Roan, was approached by this Caucasian woman. And she said, I would like to help a black go to college and basically fund their education. So Mr. Roan looked at the 3 of us. The other 2 were from middle-class families, and I was, from kind of still a poor environment, poor family, and had the smarts. So he told her, Eddie Brown is the person you should fund. And for every year that I was at Howard, she did not give me the money. She would send a check to Howard to pay the full ride. It covered tuition, room and board, books for all 4 years at Howard. And unfortunately, I never met her, and I still don't know who
she is. That's amazing.
And that's why in the book I call her Lady B.
Lady B.
Yeah. But, that kind of put something, I guess, in my consciousness that if I'm ever in a position financially to help someone in many different ways, whether it's education or other ways, that I really would like to try to repay what she did for me.
One of the things it struck me as you were talking and thinking about the book, that from an early age, you had two things, it seemed to me. One was you were always very frugal, even as a kid.
That's correct.
You could hold on to a penny.
Yep. That $1,000 bill I would take around but not spend.
See, you knew how to hold on to save money, which is how you could buy your car when you were a teenager.
Right.
But you also grew up in a world where your word was your bond.
That's correct. If you gave your word, you had to.
So those two factors say a lot about you and the character you bring into this grown-up world that you're about to enter.
Yes. It was a good foundation.
So we're going to take a break and come to this grown-up world and talk about how Eddie Brown, born of a 13-year-old mother, ends up as one of Baltimore's top business people, one of the nation's top capital managers, a huge philanthropist. How do you get there? What is that road? You can join us here at 410-319-8888 as we talk about how Eddie Brown got to this road. We're talking about his book, Beating the Odds, Eddie Brown's Investing in Life Strategies. And Eddie Brown will be at the Enoch Pratt Library tomorrow night, 7 o'clock on Cathedral Street. So join us there for that, too. But right now, stay with us and join us here for this conversation. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And you can hear their short pieces on our show, as well as go to our steinershow.org and click on their banner and find out more about what the Department of Housing can do for you. Number here is 410-319-8888. We're talking with Eddie Brown, owner, founder of Brown Capital Management, who's written at last his biography, Beating the Odds, Eddie Brown's Investing in Life Strategies. And tomorrow night will be at the Enoch Pratt Library on Cathedral Street at 7 p.m., so you don't want to miss that and have a chance to be there in person to meet Eddie Brown and hear his story as you're hearing it now, but have a chance to ask him questions as well. So there's so many pieces I want to make sure that we cover.
Mm-hmm.
And we will cover them. I think the important components of this. So you go off to Howard University.
Correct.
You have this full scholarship given to you by a white woman who you do not know.
Still
don't know who this person is.
Correct. Which was a major mistake, you know, but I just was too young and not thoughtful enough to have looked her up.
But you wrote her a letter every year.
Wrote her a letter, but I never heard back.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I wrote her a letter every year thanking her, letting her know how I did that year. But it was a one-way street.
And at Howard University is where you, you've had your girlfriends before. You're talking about the white girlfriend you had in Allentown when you were, what was it, Magnificent Kings? You were part of this semi-gang where you were singing.
Fabulous Kings.
Fabulous Kings. You weren't really a gang. You were more of a singing.
Well, no, the Fabulous Kings, we were really a gang. We used to wear pink jackets.
But not going out and causing fights and troubles.
No,
not
no.
Not that kind of gang.
No, not that kind of gang. Right.
That's what I meant.
No.
Right.
That's correct.
But you were
just a group of guys.
Group of guys. And you, mm-hmm. and you had a singing group?
Yes, I was part of a singing group in high school, and the name of the group at the time was the Cool Tones, and we changed it along the way to the Nomads. But I was the only one that went on to college, and Jay Proctor, who was the lead singer, kept doing it, you know, and he put together a band. This was after I was at Howard. And he actually, I think he was the first one, very early in the country, that had an integrated group. He got another fella nicknamed Lucky. So it was Jay and Lucky, and they formed a group called Jay and the Techniques and went on to be quite famous. In fact, they cut 2 gold records. So it was Jay and Lucky, Jay and the Techniques, and the band was all white. So they would draw mixed audiences, you know, and I guess their most well-known record was Apple Peaches Pumpkin Pie. I think that was around 1968. And then their second gold record was Keep the Ball Rolling.
Keep the Ball Rolling, right.
So
can you still carry a tune?
Sort of. In fact, you know, when both daughters got married, I sang a song, the same song, at each of their weddings. And it was by Lady Day. I don't know if you know which song I'm talking about.
Go ahead, tell.
Mama May Have. It was God Bless the Child.
God Bless the Child, right.
Got his own. So I wanted to make a point at each of their weddings. Mama May Have, Papa May Have, but God Bless the Child.
Child. Who can make his own.
That's correct. So I think they got the message.
They've both done quite well.
Yes.
Psychologist.
Very, very independent. And
wonderful doing, artist and wonderful psychologist.
Correct. Doing very well.
You're off to Howard University, and this is also where you meet
Sylvia,
the love of your life.
That's correct. And finally, you know,
it kind of blew you off once at least during the process.
Probably more than once. But you know, I was part of a fraternity. I pledged Omega Psi Phi. Every time I see these folks, Alpha and Kappa, and I said, you know, are those real fraternities? But at Howard, there's something in the center of the campus called the Q-Dial, Omega, you know, Q-Dial. And we would sing every Friday at noon, and all of the young ladies would circle around. We were the center of attraction. And my wife, to-be, Sylvia, actually was a Delta, and it was kind of a sister-brother kind of relationship. So the Omegas and Deltas were kind of sister-brother. And she, you know, liked to come around that dial. So, you know, we got to know each other, and the rest is history.
And but this going to Howard University, so you went there, and you thought you wanted to be an engineer.
I knew I wanted to be an engineer.
Right. In fact, I say thought because of how life changed later, but you knew then you wanted to be an engineer.
I knew then. Well, actually, I didn't know when I was graduating from high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And the guidance counselor had me take a test to determine my strengths. And the test pointed towards very strong in science and math and analytical. And I liked to putter around with electronics. And so the guidance counselor said, maybe you'd like to become an electrical engineer. It requires a lot of math and science and rational thinking, and problem solving, and you like electronics, you know, maybe electrical engineering. So I said, okay. So when I applied to Howard, I decided to major in electrical engineering. But I didn't have a base. I didn't know. I'd never met an engineer, knew nothing about engineering. But it really worked out. You know, it worked out, and I enjoyed the experience.
But you went to ROTC, and you got your second lieutenant bars, and you went off to work, but then were called off to the Army.
Yeah, I went to work for Martin Marietta down in Orlando as an electrical engineer after graduating from Howard. But I think I started in June, and I was called to active duty. It was supposed to be a year, but I was called to active duty in November, so just a few months.
Because of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, they called all of the ROTC folks in early.
So, but let's talk about the change that happened. I mean, you. Poor Sylvia went through a lot of changes with you.
That's correct. That's correct.
From one to the next, yep. getting this career that you created. But something happened and you began to fall in love with the idea of being in marketing, of business, of finance.
Yeah, I went, as I was progressing along my career as an electrical engineer at IBM, where I worked in upstate New York for 5 years.
Which is also odd for a black man in that period of time.
That's correct. This was 1963 to 1968.
You were often the only black man in places you went.
It seems that way. Including when I came to Baltimore with T. Rowe Price.
And still, as you write in your book, there's still, you said you were the first and last. Didn't you write that in your book?
I don't think there is another has not been another African American portfolio manager.
Right.
Equity stock, you know, working with equities. So I came to IBM, worked as an electrical engineer, had a plan to actually climb the corporate ladder into management. And as I, what happened, to make the story very brief, is I developed a sponsor, and people in corporations should always seek, especially large corporations, to find a higher level manager to kind of adopt them and be their sponsor. And that's what happened to me later at IBM, because I kept asking questions about, you know, how do I get to this level and this level and this level? And I was introduced to people at higher levels, and they finally said, this one person who turned out to be my corporate sponsor said, really, you have great technical skills. You have now, by then I had a master's in electrical engineering, but you really should understand that IBM, a big part, even though it's a great technology company, is marketing. So you need to broaden your skill set, and I would suggest going to graduate business school and get an MBA to combine with your technical degrees to accelerate potentially your advancement up the corporate ladder. So that was the rationale of going back to graduate business school. But after I got there, I became very interested in finance and investments, and realized that people can really make a very good living doing this. And in fact, I had managed, we'd had a personal portfolio for years. Even when I worked as an engineer, I always enjoyed following the market, stock market, and companies, and, you know, trying to figure out what makes a great company and a great investment. So I had some basic knowledge and a very small portfolio, but when I found that people can really do this every day and found out about Wall Street, you know, I decided that I would like to try a different path. And so I never went back to engineering.
IBM.
Never went back to IBM.
And you never went back to IBM.
No.
And even then, because they helped put you through and gave
graduate
you
school.
Graduate school, you had to tell them that you stood up and said, look, I have another opportunity. I'd like to take it. And you did it as a mensch. You just stood up and said, this is what I have. And they said, fine, you can come back anytime you want, but go do this new job you found.
Yes. Fortunately, this sponsor, they kept me on as a regular employee. That wasn't the plan, but that's the way it turned out. And I had a fellowship from a program to encourage minorities to pursue the MBA called the Consortium. And I had the opportunity to go back. But when I told my, quote, sponsor about this very unusual opportunity to join this firm in this little town in Columbus, Indiana, that managed the wealth of a very significant family in the state, and all of the things that this would provide, he said, Ed, I know you feel kind of a moral obligation, because I told him I felt a moral obligation to return. He said, I would look out for number one, and this opportunity sounds very good. So basically, forget about, he said, I wouldn't have any qualms about pursuing it. And that gave me basically the freedom of mind and consciousness to basically switch careers and not go back.
So you went to work for Cummins?
The family founded Cummins Engine Company. And that firm is called Irwin, IRWIN, Management Company, that managed basically the wealth
of this one family.
Of the one family.
And this is where you really learned?
The investment world.
The investment world.
Yeah. In fact, they had various areas. They had real estate, they had venture capital, they had marketable securities, basically every conceivable area of investments, and I was in the marketable securities group. And after working for a year as assistant to the president's office, which gave me kind of a broad perspective of the whole firm, and then I selected to go into the marketable securities group. And after 3 years there, what happened is the kingpin of the family was 63, and I knew that he had a rule at 65, basically, you must retire, which would include himself. And I said, I wonder if he will want 85 people managing the family's wealth after he retires. And I concluded, being an analyst, you know, a very analytical mind, probably not. If it was me, I wouldn't want that as I'm, you know, winding back, cutting back. So I took the liberty of kind of looking around, anticipating that he would want to reduce the staff. And I have a predilection towards the growth style of investing. And I said, why not look for the number one firm in the country at that time in growth stocks, investing in growth stocks, and that was T. Rowe Price Associates in Baltimore, Maryland. So I sent off a letter and my resume, and it piqued their interest enough to give me an interview. And after several interviews over the course of many months, they offered me a position as an investment counselor, managing money for clients at T. Rowe Price.
It was interesting to me that that one of my interesting chapters you had in that, there were a number of them interesting chapters. I mean, all through this is you having to go up against Sylvia for a while and your wife and convince her that we were about to make another move. We're about to do. I'm going to get my MBA and go to school full time, even though
right.
And now we're going to move to Baltimore.
Right. Now, several moves, but boy, she has really stuck it out.
She has.
And a big supporter.
You two are a team. But one of the things that struck me, because it's so real in the world of business and the world of investment, is your chapter called Swimming with Sharks.
Yes.
That is, I mean, because I think that's an important chapter just for anybody who understand the viciousness of the
business world.
Of the business world.
Yeah, I was really shocked and disappointed that as I was hired to work as part of a three-person team, and over the course of the first 3 years with T. Rowe, I ended up being a team of one. And that was not, you know, sustainable. So fortunately, I landed on a very good team at T. Rowe. In fact, it was the largest team, investment team, at T. Rowe. But what happened along the way, I found that there were some jockeying for some of the very large relationships that I was involved in. And that's what I call swimming with sharks. You really have to watch what's going on around you and be aware of it. And that, you know, most people are nice, but some people are kind of vicious and will take advantage when they see, they think, maybe a weakness. And so I fortunately was able to maneuver, but you really have to watch your back.
Because this guy was attempting to take all your portfolio. That didn't mean you should be the one managing it.
That's correct, of the very large relationships.
Why would you be doing that?
Right.
How could this be happening?
Right.
So yeah. One of the things is we get into how you started Brown Capital Management, which I really want to talk about in your philosophy of investing. One of the pieces that you talk about in this book, and it's also a thing, a subtext to the book and to your life, is you have lived as a black man in mostly white business worlds, dominated by white culture in a white world.
That's correct. In 1978, there was a front page article on the Washington Post Sunday edition that said the title in big bold letters was Staying Black While Making It in a White World.
Right.
And they had selected five African Americans. I still have the article, in fact.
I'm sure you
it's
do.
Part of my archives that were in non-traditional fields that blacks normally would not be in.
Right.
And they selected me because at that time, I think I was the only African-American portfolio manager with a major investment firm in the United States at the time to, you know, kind of talk about how did I maintain my blackness when the world that I live in from a business standpoint is all white, predominantly white. And
not just for you, but for your children as well.
For children, yes. Yeah. So we lived in the suburbs. In fact, we still live the same place. And we made an effort we would come into Baltimore, take our children to black churches. We would identify families for children with, you know, black children to play with. So they realized who they are, you know, that because the world that they were living in was kind of a different world. So we made an effort. In fact, the article started off, the first paragraph said, they bus Eddie Brown's children, referring to the fact that we would make concerted efforts to get that exposure for our children.
And I mean, and that's, I mean, that to me, that that has become, I mean, I think that's a really critical feature of this. I mean, that, 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 you know, there's so few black folks who are doing what you do.
Still, that's
still,
correct.
Still, in this world. And you have to kind of always buck the tide, and you're also buffering your world with that world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an easy task.
But you have to work at it.
Right.
Yeah.
So now you decide to leave T. Rowe. Talk about the beginning of this Brown Capital Management. Am I right? This your company is the second or third largest African-American-owned investment company?
We're the second oldest,
African-American-owned
investment management firm. And I used to say in the United States, but by definition in the world, African-American-owned.
Right.
And I give credit to a firm in Chicago founded by a fellow by the name of John Rogers. It's Ariel Investments. John started Ariel in January of 1983, and I started Brown Capital in July of 1983. So we started in the same year, but he is, quote, the oldest.
So talk a bit about this. You started this company, and the majority of people working for you are African-American.
That's correct.
Right? In your firm.
Yes. I had to make a concerted effort to, you know, when you look at many predominantly white businesses, regardless of what areas, whether it's investments or others, you know, you hear this, I can't find them.
Right.
You know, I can't find them. That's why we don't have more blacks, because I can't find them qualified, you know, with the credentials. Well, I made a concerted effort to network and to look for the talent. You know, we hire the best and the brightest. You know, all of our investment folks have MBAs, several of masters in business administration, several have something called chartered financial analyst designations. Have not hired for our investment portfolio managers / analysts. We have not hired directly out of, say, graduate business school. We've hired only experienced people. And we made a concerted effort, you know, to basically search around the nation and network to find the talent. Now, we do have an integrated staff.
Yes, you do.
At all levels.
Right.
Operations, in the investment area. So also made an effort to make sure we had diversity across all of our areas, and I've succeeded at that.
And you have, but you have, and we're running out of time. And the next couple minutes is, I mean, because you have a very specific philosophy of how to get this done. You have this incredible part of your book where you talk about your idea about investing, which is different.
That's correct. The acronym is GARP, which stands for Growth at a Reasonable Price.
Right.
When I was at T. Rowe, as I said, that was the bastion in those days of the growth style of investing. Certainly, philosophically, I'm a growth style manager, which means I'm looking for companies with the capability of growing their sales and their earnings much faster than the overall economy, much faster than the overall market, stock market. But I'm very price conscious as to how much I pay for that growth. So even though I came out of the bastion of growth stock investing, I said, but I'm price conscious, so therefore I'm going to say growth at a reasonable price. And at that time, that did not exist. So I'm credited in the investment industry of having created this acronym, coined growth at a reasonable price.
And it's worked for your company.
It's worked extremely well.
What are the
just
assets
in a sentence,
now?
We manage around $4 billion
right.
total assets
under
management.
Amazing.
Yep,
right.
Across the country, clients of all types,
right.
Institutions, wealthy individuals, and we have 3 mutual funds that are open to the general public for much smaller sums.
From Brown Capital.
That Brown Capital manages. We have 3 currently. and planning to offer two more.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so we've done pretty well.
You've done very well.
Yeah, and we've had some, you know, top performance, been recognized nationally.
And you've been able to live your dream as a philanthropist.
Yes, it was publicly disclosed when we were selected, my wife and I, as Marylanders of the Year this year by the Maryland Historical Society. They wanted to have some sense of the magnitude of the dollars that we have, say, contributed to the community over the last 15 years. And I had to go back and add it up. And it turns out to be a little over $22 million.
Eddie Brown, you have to promise me one thing.
Okay.
I really want to get you back here just to talk about the business and how you grew it.
Great.
Can we do that another day?
That's another day.
We'll do that another day.
Yep.
And you can learn about this and much more tomorrow night. Eddie Brown will be at the Enoch Pratt Free Library, Cathedral Street, 7 o'clock tomorrow night, Beating the Odds, Eddie Brown's Investing in Life Strategies, a really well-written book, fascinating book about America and what America can offer and what Eddie's done with his life. Eddie, I'm glad you have come to these studios at last.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
Good to have you. See you tomorrow night at the library.
Great.
Yes. So go visit Eddie, meet Eddie tomorrow night at the Enoch Pratt Library, 7 p.m. on Cathedral Street. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland's Inflammatory Bowel Disease Program, a multidisciplinary care service dedicated to relieving symptoms and improving the quality of life of IBD patients. More information, 1-800-492-5538. Or go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Cricket Aronson and Justin Levy. We are engineered by Akisa Gunn. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. Our interns today are Justin Green, Elizabeth Walker, and Reese Peek. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, and find out information about our guests and their work, please go to our website, steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.